Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
The case that I have for you today is one that goes back a few years, but no one really seems to know about it. And yet it's exactly the stuff of horror movies that you would think would be really well known as one of Canada's most horrific and terrifying murders. Yet it's just not that well known about. This is the Peterson Family Massacre.
You obviously have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
Now, I know that a few of you are like, Kim, first of all, it's the Peterson family and it's the Shell Lake Massacre and everybody knows about this case. Well, I'm acquainted with the Shell Lake Massacre as well, but I can assure you that this is not this case. This is the Peterson family with a D, not a T. And the Shell Lake Massacre is actually, it's super well known here and there are lots of podcasts and coverage on that case, which is horrible. Like, I'm not mitigating it at all. There's just a lot more known and like talked about. Shell Lake is actually about a 3.5 hour drive south of where we're going to be talking about today. And just to give you a little rundown on that one, Victor Hoffman was 21 years old in 1967 and had recently been released from a mental health facility where he was being treated for schizophrenia. And on the morning of August 15th, 1967, he burst into the farmhouse of the Peterson family and shot all 9 family members. He shot the .22 caliber rifle that he was armed with 28 times and connected 2 targets with 27 of those shots. 47-year-old James Peterson was the first to be shot in the kitchen. 6 of the children were shot in their beds. There was Jean, 17, Mary, 13, Dorothy, 11, Pearl, 9, William, 5, and Colin, 2. Now, Mom Evelyn was found in the backyard. She was still clutching her 1-year-old son, Larry, who was also killed. There was one lone survivor, a 4-year-old Phyllis, who was hiding under the blankets between Dorothy and Pearl, and she wasn't noticed, I guess. The Petersons did have another daughter, Kathy, who was married and living in BC at the time. Now, she moved back to the farm after the murders and adopted Phyllis and then raised her. It is a very sad story and one that leaves a dark and horrific stain on our true crime past. And I'm not going to say that today's case is any worse than it. The events are not any more worse or better than any other victims of homicides. But I think it highlights why telling people's stories and keeping their names alive is so important to the healing process for families, and how important rallying and support is when a tragedy happens. The Peterson family, with a D, consisted of Dad Thomas Peterson, who was 32, Mom Bernadette, who was also 32, Connie, 11, Cynthia, 10, Grace, 8, Fred Donald, who everyone called Donnie, was 7, Robert, 5, Richard, 4, and Rhonda, 2. So you could say it was a rather large family, and they were all living in Buffalo Narrows, which is a small little village in northern Saskatchewan. And at the time, there was only about 700 people living there. I believe today there's about 1,100. Most of the residents were Cree and Métis. And by a number of mostly American podcasters, you'll often hear Métis people. Well, first you'll probably hear them referred to as Métis, but it's Métis. referred to as a mixed race, like kind of a mix of indigenous and white. But Métis is actually a very specific race, like Inuit is different from First Nations. The Métis people were the result of Scottish and French settlers taking First Nations women as wives, likely not by the woman's choice. So the Peterson family was Catholic, but they held strong indigenous culture and beliefs, and I believe they would have spoken Cree. I don't like to get into specifics about indigenous experiences in Canada because it isn't a history that I have lived, and I don't want to get anything wrong about it. It's a very complex history, and I definitely always want to acknowledge and validate intergenerational trauma that colonization has caused and is still causing. Like systemic racism is definitely a thing. And I acknowledge all of that. I just don't want to put myself in a position of trying to educate anyone because it's not my journey. And just because I read about something doesn't mean that I fully comprehend or understand it. And the history is different for every First Nations person, every First Nations family, each tribe and each band. But I also don't want to just spit out information that was reported at the time because the language now is different and we have, or at least should have, a better understanding of some things since then. So there's little things that I want to kind of try and explain along the way. So when I say something about Indigenous experiences or events, it is based on what I have read and educated myself about, not about anything that I have experienced. And I don't want any of you to think that I am knowledgeable in any way about it. Anyways, so I do not believe that Buffalo Narrows is reservation land. It's actually a village that is inhabited by mostly Cree and Métis people, but there's also, or was at that time, some white folks living there. But they all worked in the capacity of like government or education. So I get the feeling it was one of those communities that the settlers, which usually refers to white people around at the time, were trying to convert to white or European culture. So in 1969, when this story takes place, families in Buffalo Narrows had so far been spared the 60s scoop, which was a cute little nickname that we like to give for when the government came in and essentially kidnapped Indigenous children from their families and took them to live in residential schools, which were run by the churches that indoctrinated children by stripping them of their language, their culture, their families, which of course led to that intergenerational trauma that I talked about, which is way too complex of an issue to get into in one episode. But at the time, Buffalo Narrows was very remote. So there's only one road in and one road out of the village. And in the winter, which saw temperatures around minus 40 degrees, which actually is the same in Celsius as it is in Fahrenheit, it's basically as cold as a witch's nipple, as we say. And you could only get into town, in and out of town at that time of the year by bush plane. So I guess a lot of white people didn't want to go there and mostly left the people alone. Now, the town itself is kind of wedged between Churchill Lake and Peter Pond Lake. Now, the Peterson family were considered actually fairly well off for the town as far as comparisons go. And they lived, all nine of them, in a small two-bedroom little house. But Tom worked as a laborer. Now, the work was seasonal, so it wasn't consistent all year round, but he took whatever jobs that he could. And then when the off season came, he didn't have any work. So he somehow managed to keep his family housed and fed all year round. Most of the labor jobs around that area were in logging and fishing industries. So in the winters, work would be pretty hard to come by. So Bernadette and Tom had slept in one room, likely with Rhonda as well, because she was two. And then the other kids shared the other bedroom. So it was tight quarters for sure. You could definitely say that, but somehow they managed. Now, Bernadette's mom lived nearby, and the kids would sometimes have sleepovers at her place, likely to kind of free up a little bit of space every once in a while to give the kiddos a little bit more sleeping room. But she had some health issues, so she couldn't do much more than like the odd sleepover here and there. And they were a very close-knit family, like not just as a family, but this community in itself was very close-knit. So in December of 1968, Tom had been laid off for the season and he was starting the lean wages season. And on January 28th or so, like around that time, the Petersons had a few friends over for some drinks, and it being a small town, it was probably one of those gatherings where people would just kind of show up. They'd stay for a little bit and then they'd leave. And one of the people that came that evening was one of their neighbors. Now, I don't think he lived directly next door, but close by. It was 19-year-old Fred Moses McCallum. Now, Fred had played hockey. He was very good at it, mostly because he was a pretty aggressive player. He also worked labor jobs, but he didn't save his pennies quite as well as Tom was doing, probably because Tom had a family to take care of and Fred did not. Now, Fred attended the same church as the Petersons. He knew them from the neighborhood. Like, they weren't like best friends or anything, but just knew each other like acquaintances. And 2 years prior, he had served some time in juvie for some minor crime. And a lot of the issues that Fred had growing up was a result of his mom. She had some drinking issues. She was a single mom with 8 kids. And apparently each kid had like a different father. And that was somewhat looked down on by a lot of the townsfolk. So chances are that Fred was kind of considered like fruit of the poison tree, so to speak. So he'd spent some time in and out of foster care. He was troubled for sure. And apparently while in juvie, he did have an assessment done and showed that he was starting to have some mental health issues. However, it was like 1966 at that point. So like kids with epilepsy were considered to be possessed by demons. So you got to take some of that with a grain of salt. Anyways, Fred showed up at the Peterson house and asked to have a drink, like with alcohol in it. And Bernadette's had said no. Now, no one really knows what happened because it wasn't really reported on, but the rumors is that Fred got pretty gosh darn upset about this, and Bernadette wound up asking him to leave. But no one really knows what that argument was really about. It's just kind of rumored to have been about her refusing him booze. Anyways, the gathering carried on, and then the next day, the family's friend, 48-year-old John Baptiste Herman, who was from LaLanche, which is a neighboring town, was staying with them on their couch. And as it was late January, the temperature is minus 40 and the roads would have been probably snowed in. This was kind of a regular thing. So he was staying over for a few days until the roads opened up again. Probably to make a little bit of room because they now had a guest staying with them, Connie and Cynthia went to their grandmother's that night for a sleepover. And details are sketchy on this because it's kind of pieced together by old archives news articles that are like really disjointed due to the dates and details. So I'm not going to say that these events happened exactly like this, but I mean, you're going to get the gist of what happened. Sometime in the middle of the night on January 30th, 1969, the parish priest got a phone call from Fred, who babbled on something about the Petersons needing their last rites read to them. And the priest sensed that Fred was just kind of drunk dialing him, so he hung up on him. But Fred calls back saying, rather calmly, that he just killed everyone at the Petersons' house and he's now at his aunt's place. And he told them that he didn't remember anything other than he kind of woke up to find himself in the children's bedroom and was smelling like blood and meat. And then suddenly realized that there were dead people. And his first thought was, like, he has to catch this guy, whoever did this awful thing. And then he saw himself in the reflection of a mirror in the bedroom with all this blood on him and realized the whodunit was actually him. So he's at his aunt's place now. His aunt wasn't home when he got there, which was around 3 a.m. But his 15-year-old cousin had let him in. So, like, that's what's up. Well, the priest is like, I guess I should go check this out. And he shows up at the Peterson's house to discover an absolute bloodbath and quickly calls the RCMP. Now, I'm not sure how quickly the RCMP would have been able to get there. They would have had to come from probably a neighboring community. And with the roads snowed in, it probably took a little bit of time. But when they did get there, the Peterson house was what they call the worst crime scene that I'm sure any of them had ever seen in their careers and since.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Fred had punched through the glass of the front door and then unlocked the door carrying a fire axe. So not just any axe, but one of those long-handled, very heavy ones that firefighters use. And this likely would have woken up John, who was on the couch. So he would have stood up. He was struck in the head repeatedly with this axe. He was found bludgeoned on the floor in the living room. In the children's bedroom was all five children in their beds and all apparently dead from multiple axe wounds to the heads. And then the mutilated bodies of Tom and Bernadette in their bed as well. Now, there's no reporting on any defensive wounds at all. So hopefully they were all sleeping when they were killed and no one woke up during any of it. But that seems unlikely. And while taking in the scene of absolute horror in the children's room, by they're scanning the room with a large police flashlight, 7-year-old Donnie suddenly sat up, likely causing a physical reaction from the officers. He had suffered head injuries to both the front and back of his head, but was miraculously still alive. Now, Bernadette was also found technically alive. She was clinging to life. She was unconscious, but she still had a slight pulse. She died shortly after arriving at the hospital. But Donnie remained in a coma for a few months, but managed to pull through. He was, of course, now an orphan and having lost 5 of his siblings. And after this massacre that he had done, Fred then walked past all of the bodies and then out the door to his aunt's house where he knocked on the door. So when the police came to collect him, he's sitting at the kitchen table, probably next to his wide-eyed aunt and 15-year-old cousin, sipping on a cup of tea. Now, apparently, according to some reporting at the time, Fred said to the arresting officers, "I killed them, so what?" And how he had left 3 of them alive, which was actually only 2 of them, which he wouldn't have known that. So I'm just doubting that he said any of that stuff. He also apparently said that when he got out of prison, he was going to kill them too, referring to the officers. But regardless if he said that or not, it was reported that he was calm, cool, and collected when he was arrested and wasn't exactly showing a lot of remorse about it. And he also never gave a reason why he had done it. At the trial, he claimed to not be guilty, but by reason of insanity. But the neighbors and some of the townsfolk along with the prosecution believe that his motive was really about being mad about what went down at that party 2 days before. And I'm more inclined to agree with the prosecutors and the neighbors on that. Not so much about the actual motive, because I wasn't there. But for all 9 people, with the exception of maybe John Herman, to have been killed in their beds, that would involve some sneaking around. And if you're sneaking around, you know what you did was wrong. So I don't think you're insane. Now, pretty much everyone in town came to the funeral for the family, which was held for all of them on the same day. There was a line of caskets, some of them very tiny, as you can imagine, and a wall of people to give their respects. So the Petersons were a really well-liked family. They were God-fearing and had a hard-working work ethic, and the shock and just the appall that the townspeople felt was just really palpable at the time. Now, as a refresher for you, back in 1969, mental health was looked at a little bit differently than it is today. And most of the time, if you murdered somebody, it was pretty much agreed that you were deranged and crazy, and crazy would be the term that they'd used back then. But also back then, serial killers hadn't really been discovered yet. That someone could be perfectly capable of rational thought and yet murder and dismember a person and have sex with their bodies. And nowadays, we're pretty much more aware of mental health issues, but the bar to claim you're not responsible for your actions is much, much higher. So during a trial in 1969, when you had a guy that says, I was crazy at the time, well, that would make perfect sense. Like, as and then you get a psychiatrist that gets up on the stand and starts talking about Freud and DSM stuff, and it all sounds very official. But they also weren't aware of a thing called malingering back then, like the faking it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it was complicated back then. So anyways, at first he wasn't even found fit to stand trial. And then he got a little bit better and he stood trial in 1970. Now, little Donnie actually testified and was able to point to him being the one that had killed his family. They brought in this giant axe into the trial. It was still caked with dried blood and it was all kinds of drama. And Fred said that he regretted not killing the entire family and leaving three of them alive. Now, a psychiatrist explained what psychosis was, and after about 4.5 hours, the jury of all white men found him not guilty by reason of insanity, or what we call NCR, not criminally responsible. Now, apparently he was sent to the Prince Albert Penitentiary, but later he was moved to that Oak Ridge Mental Hospital, the one from the Woodcock murders that was doing all kinds of weird experiments with LSD on his patients. Now it's part of the Pentagoshi in Ontario and has been renamed the Waypoint Center. In 1989, he was released under the condition that he leave and never return to Saskatchewan. So basically be somebody else's problem. And then as far as anyone knows now or wherever, he's living in Ontario somewhere. He'd be about 74 now if he's still alive. And that may be the end of the story as far as the Peterson family goes. But what happened to Donnie, Connie, and Cynthia, like the three survivors of such a terrible and horrific tragedy. Like, where are they now and how did they fare out? Well, not good. So Connie and Cynthia were staying with their grandmother when the family was killed, and Donnie remained in the hospital in a coma for like a number of months. Social services, who were really at that time nothing more than an agency paid by the government to grab kids out of Indigenous families and put them with white families for any reason that they could possibly come up with, were highly starting to sniff around. And despite their grandmother pleading with them to let her keep the kids, they said that she wasn't in a good enough health, and they took all of them away to live in Saskatoon with other families, which would have been a huge culture shock for them coming from such a small community to the city and then having lost their family under such traumatic and horrible circumstances. And while they were there, Cynthia said that she received a grand total of 2 hours of counseling, which consisted of the therapist showing photos from the crime scene, like shoving them in her face and asking her what she thought about it, and zero follow-up on any of them. Their grandmother refused to give up, and they were finally back with her for the rest of their childhood, pretty much, which was good, but she didn't really have any assistance for them. She had to raise them with only her old age pension and none of the services and help that come when you actually take in foster kids. So Cynthia and Connie grew up to be, well, together they had a very complicated relationship with each other, and it's still too emotional for them a lot of times when they do get together to have any real joy in their life and their relationships. Now, Donnie, well, he grew up to be angry and troubled and spent time in a boys' home in North Saskatchewan and was in and out of juvie. And a large part of his rebellion was actually spurred on by wanting to go to prison so that he could run into Fred while he was there and like have words with him, I guess. And the three were never even told anything about the trial or where or what had happened to Fred, but they never did meet up. Donnie did grow up to have a family of his own, but sometime in the 1980s, when Donnie was still quite young, Cynthia, Donnie, and their uncle were driving down the road leading to the beach that's in Buffalo Narrows, and they were sideswiped by a car. And when they got out to check the damage, Cynthia and Donnie were both struck by a passing car. Donnie was killed and Cynthia spent a number of months in the hospital. Both Cynthia and Connie still live in Buffalo Narrows. They are basically too broke, they say, to go anywhere else, even though the town brings them really nothing but sad and bitter memories, which isn't helped by the fact that Fred's family is also still living there, and they worry constantly that Fred's going to return and maybe finish the job. Now, sometimes there's rumors that he's in town visiting and they lock their doors and windows, and they just live in terror all the time. Connie's daughter Jamie told CBC, "We've heard stories that he's been here in town. We have heard a bunch of stuff that he's around. It is very scary to see your parents go through the things that they do." Now, the sisters have never had access to any records on Fred's whereabouts at all. They feel shunned by the people in town by having kind of the stigma of tragedy attached to them. They are all too aware of all of the podcasts and coverage that the Shell Lake Massacre gets. Phyllis, who was the lone survivor in that tragedy, was taken in by her sister, and the community just really rallied in support of her. There are no memorials or legacy funds, nothing in memory of their own family. So they desperately want, really what they want is some counseling and some mental health support services, but there's really only one place that they can go to in Buffalo Narrows, and it feels too, like, not private for them to share their feelings in the very town that they kind of feel avoids eye contact with them as it is. So they don't trust anyone. They struggle with feeling really anything good ever. And when people do hear their story, they hear about how, you know, something's going to be done for them, but then nothing ever is. They just feel really forgotten. Connie says, "I feel like we were alone in this world and it was just our little family." So Cynthia and Connie's kids did hold a memorial for the family and John Herman as well at the Buffalo Narrows Friendship Center 6 years ago. And the younger family members, led by Connie's granddaughter Shaylee, started a GoFundMe page to raise money to replace the battered and worn headstone that marks all of the family's graves. And they want a new one as like their own memorial, and to also include Donnie's name on it as well. As Cynthia said, "They've had this tombstone for 50 years. It's about time we change it. It's going to cost a lot of money to do it." Now, at the time the GoFundMe page was started, it was already at about $500. So I had actually hoped that when I looked it up, they would have reached their goal of $10,000 by now. But sadly, I just looked it up and it's only at $1,575. Now, I tried to make a donation, but it's giving me an error message, so I'm not sure that it's still active. The administrator for the village of Buffalo Narrows says that there is a plan in progress for some kind of memorial, but the family hasn't heard any of those plans at all. Shaylee's biggest hope is for some healing and some counseling. "I just want them to be able to love each other and get the counseling they need, because they should be together. This is just such a sad, sad story. And not just because so many people were brutally murdered in their sleep, but because of the trauma and tragedy that it just kind of snowballs from it all. And that three children, like children, little wee children, were just kind of forgotten about and left to just fend for themselves." As a grown woman in my 50s, albeit early 50s, I need help with learning how to, like, put up boundaries and not have a panic attack when my alarm clock doesn't go off and I'm going to be late. Like, how on earth are children expected to come out the other side of such deep and horrible events without just a little bit of help? And when you don't get that help, as help to be like as well adjusted in society as you can be, well, then how do you raise kids that are, and how do they raise their own children to be? And like, you can just sort of see how it just gives you a little glimmer of how intergenerational trauma works and how it happens. And that was the story of the Peterson family that you likely didn't know. I'm going to be back again next week with another case. As always, thank you so much for listening. And in the meantime, while you wait for the next episode, do your thing with rates, reviews, and sign up for the exclusive, all that stuff.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.